It's Monday, August 2nd. We said we were in a race against variants. Have we already lost? We start here. The CDC suggests that if a vaccinated person gets the Delta variant, they're as contagious as anyone else.
The Delta variant could be just as contagious as the chickenpox.
But experts are warning this is actually more of a reason to get the vaccine. We'll explain why. They were behind, and now a lot of them are down and out.
We're talking about 3 million renters who say that they are worried right now about facing a threat of eviction.
Democrats claim they didn't want this eviction moratorium to expire, so why didn't they do anything about it? And people have argued over whether inmates should vote. But no one expected this.
So you're zooming from inside this cell block.
Zooming from the inside.
You have an office.
What happens when a man behind bars runs for office and wins? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. There's a case to be made that the scariness of the Delta variant is actually prompting more Americans to get vaccinated right now. Over the last month, the U.S. went from 500,000 people a day getting their shot to close to 700,000. That's pretty good. That's like a 40% increase. Except when you look at how many people are getting infected right now, because the number of COVID cases in that same time frame hasn't gone up 40%. It's gone up 300%.
The U.S. topping 100,000 cases Saturday for the first time since early February.
Nationwide hospital admissions surging to more than 6,000 a day.
In Austin, Texas, there are only 7 beds available for a population of over 2.3 million people.
Hospitals are having to set up tents to treat non-COVID patients.
And we're intubating and losing people that are my age and younger.
This weekend, Florida saw its biggest one-day increase in COVID cases of this entire pandemic. Meaning, as fast as the coronavirus was able to spread last year, this version, the Delta variant, could spread even faster. And late last week, the Washington Post obtained this slideshow put together by the CDC. It did not end up being released, which happens. Sometimes a draft is just a draft. But ABC News has since confirmed its authenticity, and it shed some new perspective on how scientists might see this variant. Let's go straight to ABC's Sony Salzman with our medical unit this morning. Sony, how is the CDC treating the Delta variant right now?
Yeah, so there are still a lot of questions about the Delta variant, and this slide deck contained a lot of interesting details about it, implying that the Delta variant could be just as contagious as the chickenpox, for example.
Delta appears to be more transmissible than Ebola, the common cold, and the seasonal flu. In fact, the preliminary data show Delta could spread as easily as chickenpox, and that means that an infected person could possibly make up to 9 other people sick.
So we're still reporting that out, and generally speaking, I would say what we have learned about the Delta variant is that Delta is different.
I approach my Provincetown trip as, life is back to normal. That, in retrospect, especially as we learn more about the Delta variant, was an error on my part.
Now, there are some studies we can point to. For example,
masks were not being used. There was very little social distancing, at least in my activities.
The CDC put out its own analysis of the Provincetown outbreak. Remember, this was an outbreak amongst mostly vaccinated people.
Within a couple days, what had started as a cold turned into something much more severe.
What the CDC found when they went to Provincetown is that if you are a vaccinated person and you are exposed to the Delta variant, the amount of virus that's able to replicate in your nose reaches a high level. In fact, almost the same level that you would expect to see in an unvaccinated person. And this leads to the logical conclusion that you may be able to spread the virus even when you're vaccinated. Like if you sneeze and all that virus goes out of your nose, maybe you can spread it to other people. And that is what caused the CDC to pause and say, you know what? In very specific situations, in areas of high transmission, vaccinated people better be safe than sorry and put those masks back on.
Well, and which is how you end up with headlines saying vaccinated people can spread this as quickly as unvaccinated people, right? But that, just so I'm clear, that's just only if you get the virus, right? Which is still less likely for a vaccinated person to contract the thing in the first place.
So a good way to think about this, Brad, is that what we were using before in terms of our public health guidance, all the rules that we had before, that was based on the best information we knew from prior versions of the virus.
When we were looking at the Alpha variant, at prior variants, in this pandemic, we were not able to see that if you were vaccinated and you are a breakthrough case, that you could transmit to others.
So we are still learning about this Delta variant. One of the key things that we are learning about it is that unlike prior variants, it does seem that it's possible to transmit between vaccinated people.
Because no vaccine is 100% effective, which means in areas of high volume of infection, vaccinated people will get infected. Thank goodness, for the most part, they will not get seriously ill. They will generally.
But what we still don't know is how often that happens, how likely that happens. Right now, all evidence points to the fact that if you are vaccinated, it's less likely that you will pass the virus along, including the Delta variant. So right now, all evidence suggests that getting vaccinated is the best way to slow the spread of the virus. In addition to that, getting vaccinated obviously helps protect you from those severe outcomes, hospitalization, dying, even if you do experience one of those breakthrough infections.
In Nebraska, Shelley Wachter was unvaccinated when she was diagnosed with COVID-19. She's now speaking out from her hospital bed.
I could have saved myself and my family so much by having gotten the immunization.
And I think what is really important to keep in context here is that the overwhelming majority of people with COVID-19 in our hospitals and sick with COVID-19 are unvaccinated. And this bad news about Delta potentially being able to spread between vaccinated people is not good, but it doesn't mean that this is suddenly a pandemic of the vaccinated. It is still largely a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Well, and that's the thing, because even if, say, 100,000 vaccinated Americans get COVID, that is a crazy big number of people. It sounds like a ton. Well, 160 million Americans have gotten the vaccine, so that's still like a 99.9% success rate. But if you do happen to contract it, the idea you could spread it so easily after that, that you got all that virus hanging out in your nose, is a dramatic re-envisioning of what the months ahead could look like. Sony Salzman, thank you.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, lots of Americans packed their bags this weekend. The difference is members of Congress at least had a choice. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
We told you on Friday morning that by this weekend, millions of renters could be facing potential eviction around the country if a federal moratorium on evictions was not extended. Well, it wasn't.
If the ban was still in place, that would give me more time.
I have no idea where I'll go, what I'll do.
Every night I've had on my mind, how am I going to pay my rent? How am I going to pay this back rent?
And so this is now August 2nd, which means for the last 24 hours, it has no longer been illegal federally for a landlord to evict their tenant for not paying their rent.
Not only has it made it impossible to evict anybody, but it's been, you know, again, from a financial standpoint, it's been devastating.
Now, there's lots of reasons this pandemic has been difficult for property owners as well. But the thing is, a ton of people in Washington say they did not want this to happen, that they could have stopped this from happening. So why didn't they? Let's bring in ABC's White House correspondent Mary Alice Parks, because Mary Alice, my usual gut reaction is just to blame Congress, right? If Congress doesn't do something, you could pass a law if you want, and Congress didn't, right? What happened?
Well, first, Brett, I think it's important to look at just how big of an issue this is. According to U.S. Census data, we're talking about 3 million renters who say that they are worried right now about facing a threat of eviction. 7 million wow. that say they're behind on rent. So we're hearing from experts that this could just be a housing crisis in the making.
Even before COVID, we had 18 million families paying over half their income on rent or mortgage. And what happened with COVID, which was counterintuitive, is for low and moderate income families, they lost income, but the demand for housing actually increased.
I think this is something that will work out.
And you're right. It's interesting that you have someone like Speaker Pelosi and President Biden saying that they wish this could happen. They wanted an extension.
So we would like the CDC to expand the moratorium.
But both pointing fingers back at each other.
The Supreme Court's ruling stated that clear and specific congressional authorization would be necessary for the CDC to extend the moratorium through July.
The original moratorium that was put in place last year during the pandemic was set to expire a month ago. There was a last minute push, kind of an emergency push, to give it one more month. That was taken to court. The Supreme Court said, look, that's nice. There's not really anything we can do now, but we really think Congress should act if you're going to keep trying to do this. Right. And so the White House said for a few weeks that they felt like their hands were tied. They weren't saying that publicly, but I have to tell you, as someone that was covering this, it didn't seem like there was a lot of movement.
What I want to make really clear is that we're going to work with Congress to get this done.
But then all of a sudden, late last week, right before it was actually about to expire, they put out this statement and said, we really think Congress should do something. And that's where you just saw all this finger pointing and outrage explode.
A group of lawmakers joining Representative Cori Bush sleeping outside the Capitol in protest. Bush once struggled with homelessness herself.
Yes, it's personal for me. I lived in a car. I lived out of a car with two babies and my partner.
They have not given an adequate reason to members of Congress or the public as to why they waited a month.
And it was a weekend of everyone kind of frustrated and yelling at each other in the Democratic Party over this.
We're not on a plane to Boca or Cancun right now. We're still here trying to do our job.
Yes.
And we do not care if we have to be here Saturday or Sunday or stay here throughout our whole vacation.
Well, and part of the, I think, frustration from members of Congress, they were like, we're going on recess starting right now, and you're telling us like we should have been crafting a bill this whole time? So at this point, can they just pass something? If Democrats all seem like on the same page and they control Congress and the White House, couldn't they have passed something new on Saturday, Sunday, today? Like, what's the holdup?
Yeah, sure. Well, the Senate is still in session, so the Senate could try to move on something. But obviously, the Senate is trickier. You'd have to get Republican votes. And we really haven't heard Republicans interested in moving on this at all. And, you know, I'm not convinced that Democrats had all of their whole caucus and party together either. There was a push, a real scramble on Friday afternoon for Democrats to maybe do a last minute bill there in the House. Mm. And they didn't do it.
Due to resistance from certain members in both the Republican and the Democratic Party, we have now almost a million people who are at risk of getting evicted.
You know, part of the real complicating factor here is that Congress has already allocated tens of billions of dollars to help renters in need.
$46 billion. This money has largely gone out to the states and local governments to implement and to give to the renters so they can pay the rent, which helps the landlords, of course, too.
The problem is only about $3 billion of that has actually gone out the door, made it into the hands of renters in need.
Why should the renters be punished for the fact that the system did not put money in their pockets to pay the rent?
And so you right now you have this Congress frustrated saying, oh, my gosh, we can't have people getting evicted. But also they just need states to get the money out. And that's a real big issue right now.
Oh, is that because, like, for all the talk of renters, I have been wondering, like, what are landlords supposed to do? Like, someone mm-hmm. tells them, sorry, I lost my job. But whatever, like, you still might owe money to the bank, or you might need money to keep that property livable for the tenant. Like, what are you supposed to do? And it sounds like that's where some of these rental dollars come in.
Right. I mean, in theory, those rental dollars help not only the renter pay their rent, but the landlord get rent paid, you know, and especially if there's months of back rent owed. And so that's going to be tricky for landlords right now going forward, because if they just evict someone, it gets a lot harder to recoup some of that back pay.
In general, I'm going to have to increase rent. I'm going to have to do a much better job screening tenants. So anybody that doesn't have a credit score of 700 or more need not apply.
And there is all this money sitting there in rental assistance, but some states have just been very slow to get it out the door.
President Biden is now putting pressure on state and local governments. In a statement, he says that they must take all possible steps to immediately distribute those rental assistance funds.
There are some local eviction moratoriums, including in some big states like California and New York and a handful of others. So I think that it's worth, if people are feeling like they're on the brink, they're having tough conversations with their landlord, it's worth checking out what the rules are locally. This isn't necessarily applying to everyone across the board the same.
Right, like you're hoping that you can get some of this federal money, but if none of it's flowing, what the heck are you supposed to do? All right, Mary L.S. Parks, really helpful. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Brad.
In many states, it's been a given for much of our lives. You cannot vote if you're under 18 or if you're a felon. The reasoning has been convicted felons chose to go against our basic rules in a democracy, so they've given up their right to participate. That thinking has changed, though, recently in several states, which are not limited to red or blue.
According to the voting rights advocacy group Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, of the 1.4 million ex-felons in Florida, 87,000, or 6.2%, registered to vote in the 2020 election.
Some jurisdictions not only extend voting rights to former inmates, but current ones. And the thinking goes the government controls every aspect of their lives, so why wouldn't they be allowed to vote for their representatives? But what happens when current inmates aren't just voting, but running for office themselves? ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer got exclusive access with someone who didn't just run, he won an elected position while still incarcerated. And Devin, let's be clear, this is someone who's still serving time for murder.
More than 27 years so far behind bars, Brad. Joel Castone is 44 years old today. He was convicted of shooting a young kid in a parking lot at a carryout store in Southeast D.C. In 1994.
So how does it feel to be a commissioner?
I feel very humbling. You know, a huge, great responsibility is now that has been cast upon my shoulders.
And he's turned his life around. This is an incredible story of redemption through politics. It's also a story of how voting rights in those three localities in the U.S. you've mentioned, Vermont, Maine, the District of Columbia just last year, are now being expanded, even in this really difficult climate for voting rights.
Had you ever voted before?
I never voted before.
So you were running for office and you had never even participated, in the democratic process before.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't it amazing? And how you can say, I want to be a part of something, but because the laws have prevented you, these barriers in place, and now these barriers are removed.
And in following some social science that's out there, Brad, that says inmates behind bars who engage in civil discourse, who educate themselves, are much less likely to be repeat offenders.
And if you treat it like a person, you can behave like a person. And that's what we want.
And that is what this young man, Joel Castone, is out to prove.
Well, and I want to get into kind of the broader sociological implications and everything, but I'm also just curious, like, wait, this is a thing? Can you just run for office while you're incarcerated? And who votes for you?
Well, Joel Castone here in the District of Columbia is the first incarcerated American ever to run for office and win with the votes of other incarcerated Americans. So this is a groundbreaking election. It happened in June, Brad, shortly after D.C. changed its voting laws.
Imagine a single-member district where every voice matters, every concern is heard, and every person is valued. Hello, everyone. My name is Will Castone, and I'm proud to be running for the 7F07 AMCC.
This is a guy who ran a campaign. He discovered with help from one of his mentors at Georgetown University that because inmates in D.C. can vote, they can also run.
I am serious about your concerns.
He threw his hat in the ring for this local government position. We should say this is a low-level advisory neighborhood commission position.
It's a small voter pool.
Small voter pool, but representing a couple thousand residents in part of the nation's capital, helping them oversee issues, liquor licenses, sidewalk repair, public safety, of all things, is under the purview of this commission.
I will be your biggest advocate to make sure that your voice and your concerns are heard. Thank you for your time.
History has been made in the seat of political power in our country. Joel Castone will be the first
incarcerated person to hold public office in Washington, D.C.
And he won with several hundred votes in a special election. And Brad, it's fascinating. He won, of course, the votes of some of his fellow incarcerated inmates, his constituents.
This vacant district in Southeast D.C. includes the correctional facilities, a nearby women's shelter, and this new apartment complex.
But there are so many other people living in this district that he's never met before. People, neighborhoods, luxury apartment complexes he's never even seen. He represents them as well.
But so then how would this work? Like if apparently he's slated to be released later this year. But until then, he has this job. Do you have to obey the prison like lights out rules? You know, do you attend meetings in person? How does this work?
You're a neat freak, very organized.
I like that. This is one of mine.
Yeah, Brad, I had the honor really to go inside DC prison and sit down with Castone recently.
Good morning, Wyoming.
Good morning.
We were taken into a special cell block, really where a bunch of a group, 13, 14, high-achieving, if you will, inmates, those who are really determined to turn their lives around, are housed.
You know, I have, four certificates when he was teaching financial literacy in USP Lee County. Also, he teaches Spanish.
They're participating in a mentorship program. They're taking classes together. And Joel Castone is really the dean of this wing.
You oversee everything from liquor license approvals to sidewalk repair to public safety. Can you credibly advocate for public safety from in here?
Wow, you've done your homework. Let me say that. You've done your homework. Yes, I can, because those matters are matters that matters to my constituents. And so it behooves me to educate myself.
They even gave him an office, Brad, where he gets computer connection because he won this election and needs to spend at least some of his time when he's out of his cell, electronically at least, communicating with constituents.
And so with a computer, it allows me to be able to engage people doing Zoom, Google Meet, et cetera, which is the common practice happening right now as we come out of the global pandemic restrictions.
So you're Zooming from inside this cell block.
I'm Zooming from the
inside. You have an office inside.
But we got to see him do his work, and he seems to be taking it all in stride so far.
Yeah, and if you're wondering how's the victim's family feel, they're actually supportive. They said they believe in forgiveness. They welcome what they say looks like a really positive change. So then zooming out, Devin, because this is the District of Columbia, right? It's one jurisdiction out of so many in this country where, you know, some felons can vote, others they can't. But are we going to see more of this? Like, is this kind of the natural evolution of treating inmates as functioning members of a local society?
Well, this is still a pretty cutting edge idea, Brad, to have incarcerated Americans vote while they're incarcerated.
What's the biggest barrier to more states, more legislatures joining D.C., Maine, and Vermont in this effort?
Well, I think it's
stigma.
It's stigma, absolutely. It's just so easy to go and look up someone's crime and say, look at what they did.
But Mark Howard, he's a leading expert in felon voting rights at Georgetown University. He and I had a conversation. He said most other developed democracies in the world, much of Europe, allows this, Brad.
In some countries, they actually bring the ballots to the prisons, and others they allow it by absentee. In other words, in most places, you don't lose your humanity, you don't lose your civil rights, social rights, political rights when you're incarcerated.
As he says, the social science, the studies show that by engaging these prisoners, even prisoners in there for a really long time, actually helps reduce recidivism in the long run. Remember, 95% of people in this country who are behind bars are going to get out.
I never want to minimize the severity of crime when there are victims. That said, right, while still acknowledging that gravity, the person who is involved in such a crime, particularly at a young age, is still a human being, is still capable of transformation.
And so his point is, we want them engaged, we want them educated, we want them part of these communities, not ostracized and cut off, and in his view, more likely to return behind bars.
You think of these jobs, these local jobs, as kind of low-pressure ones. Well, he's got a lot riding on this one, I think, for everyone involved. Devin Dwyer, really interesting. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
We're going to take one more quick break. When we return, do you still have to be a team player when the team is trying to kidnap you? One last thing is next. And one last thing. Sometimes athletes can be outspoken, even critical of their coaches. It usually doesn't mean, though, that they're going to be taken.
Another headline out of Tokyo about an alleged attempt by Belarus to forcibly return one of their athletes to the country.
Yesterday in Tokyo, amid the Olympic Games, a sprinter from Belarus said that shortly after she criticized her coaching staff, she wasn't just kicked off of her scheduled race, she was hustled into a car against her will and taken to the airport. It started when Kristina Tsimonitskaya said coaches had added her to a relay race without even telling her. Back home, government officials called her accusation a treacherous betrayal.
The Belarusian Olympic Committee said in a statement that coaches had decided to withdraw Tsimonitskaya from the Games on doctor's advice about her emotional psychological state.
Soon after, she was tweeting she was essentially being kidnapped by her own government. Now, that sounds familiar. Well, it should.
Growing international outrage over what's being called state-sponsored hijacking.
Earlier this year, the president of Belarus scrambled fighter jets to get someone who had fled the country back into the country.
They were checking our suitcases, but at the same time, they were arresting the journalist.
His own son runs the National Olympic Committee, and several other Olympians have already been arrested over the last year.
Hundreds of thousands of people demanding the pro-Russian president in power for 26 years step down.
The International Olympic Committee quickly said it was investigating and put someone at the airport with her as she asked for asylum in Western Europe. Tsimonitskaya tweeted she feels safe for now, but that she no longer has any intentions of returning home, ever. I mean, I'm glad she says she feels safe, but don't worry, we put a guy with her at the airport because, like, a country with its own KGB might be after her? It's a weird position for the IOC. Hey, a lot of reaction to our interview with a renter who was about to be evicted last week. Remember, you can always say hi, get updates on Twitter at StartHereABC. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.